Welcome to Between the Lines, an Oaks Church Brooklyn podcast where we go behind the scenes of our current series, The Story of God, alongside our pastors and a few friends. We hope you enjoy.
All right, we're back, my friend.
We're back.
Back once again with another Between the Lines.
Yes, sir. We never introduce ourselves, by the way.
Yeah.
For many people, most people know us, but we all could just be two voices.
Why don't we introduce each other?
Okay.
So I am here with my brother, Ryan Diaz, pastor of discipleship, father to a soon-to-be-born son, husband to Janice, reader of books. Quoter of old dead people.
Yeah, this is great. I feel like I was on Game of Thrones for a moment there.
Yes.
The first of his name.
And
I'm here with Patrick Boatwright, who is the lead pastor of Oaks Church Brooklyn. He is married to Catherine, the father of James, the breakdancer himself. Yes. And the lover of Howard Thurman, who he always has a meditation from to share with us.
Listen, that should be a resource.
Yeah, honestly, you should just start listening to Howard Thurman.
Every week. If you guys don't know, Howard Thurman is a mystic and a contemplative and just my OG. Just love a good Howard Thurman meditation. So that's true. Here we are. Well, the hits keep on rolling.
Yeah,
we are now fully into this chapter, the covenant of Abraham. Last week we talked about the covenant fathers,
and the
weight of the covenant on the men in this story.
Mm-hmm.
And this week we went through covenant mothers and really kind of exploring the weight of the covenant on wombs. And I'm curious, what for you kind of like stuck out in this place in the narrative that we're in?
Yeah, I think for me what stuck out is, I mean, Genesis is such a brilliant literary text, and I think we mentioned this briefly last week, but just to bring it up again, in the Genesis 3 we get this picture, this portrait of what some texts translate as the enmity between man and woman. Mm-hmm. And in these narratives we explored this past Sunday, that this is actually the first time we're really seeing that played out in its fullness. And it does lead one to think of, man, this beautiful promise of God, which is supposed to be the blessing for the nations, has become for these people in their brokenness a curse and a weight.
Mm. Yeah, that's an interesting thing you're bringing up. Like it points me to, how many times have we sat with next to a person, and this is kind of some form of this anxiety.
Yeah.
I thought God was with me in whatever X is, whatever circumstance, and yet I'm experiencing anxiety because how can I be in the presence of God and in the plans of God and there be so much pain?
Yeah. And I think that is like a seminal just question for the experience of the life of faith. Like, to your point, how many people you sit across from at a cafe or coffee shop having a pastoral meeting, and that is the wrestle. How can the plans and purposes of God feel so weighty and so difficult?
Which leads to me, I am so surprised. We get, and this has been the joy of my life the past couple months, doing this podcast with you, introducing this question and answer format into our Sunday teachings. I am so shocked about a question, not that I got, but that I didn't get.
Yeah. Okay. What is it?
Not a single person asked, what do we do with God sending Hagar back into slavery?
Yeah, it's a big question, and no one kind of like was like, huh?
I like asked that question. Like,
Like,
you know, like I'm like, wait, like, do you, like, wait? She's like, imagine like Harriet Tubman makes it to Canada, or I guess she wasn't all the way to Canada. Maybe she's like, you know, Philly.
Sure.
And Jesus like catches her and is like, not catching because he's not trying to chase her, but you know what I'm saying? Jesus comes across her in Philly and is like, Harriet, my daughter, love you. Turn on and head on back.
That's wild.
Like, what?
Yeah, no. And I think that, I mean, before we even go to like maybe possibly exploring responding to that question, like, what's that? In that tension for you, you know?
So, I mean, it hits different being black, you know?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Like, slavery. And I think it's, in this point, we should obviously nod to that there is a
difference.
There is a difference between American chattel slavery of the transatlantic slave trade and the forms of slavery that occurred in the ancient Near East and then Mesopotamian cultures.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so there's some functional difference in how one enters slavery, how one could potentially exit slavery. There is some codified care and concern for slaves in mm-hmm. the ancient Near East, particularly in the Hebrew culture. There are laws that really do more so than their neighbors seek the welfare of slaves. So there is a distinction. And yet, where there is a corollary is that you have people in servitude.
Yeah.
And particularly, say, for Hagar, there is a sexual component. There is a form of sexual violence.
Yeah.
That occurs, that I think is explicit, is made clear even in the contempt that she holds for Sarai when she becomes pregnant.
Yeah. Mm.
And the contempt that Sarai holds for her. Like, this isn't consent. Like, someone asked the question, what's the difference between, like, say, servant, where some translations translate, you know, this word, like, servant, others say slave. I honestly think that's a matter of politics.
Yeah.
But anyway, yeah, like that's, so I think like that requires us to wrestle. What do we make of a God that would send people, particularly, imagine this now, after she says, you're Elroy, you're the one who sees me. And he says, like, go back. I don't think we can just like, oh, cool. At least I can't.
Yeah. And I wonder, I mean, there's a way, and I think there's two ways to tackle this question. One's maybe a more theological, and one's more of like a historical question.
Sure.
In that, in the, if Sarai wants to do the most damage to Hagar, exile is actually the best option. Because to be outside a sort of family unit in the ancient world with the requisite protections and resources, I think a family like Abram, which we know he's a very well-off person, he kind of has his own even personal army.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so it's at partly that exile is akin to a death sentence unless she, Hagar, and Ishmael can make it to safety. And so there is this sense in which you could read the sending back as a provision for their safety, but that still doesn't, I think, wrestle with the emotional, relational tension of being sent back to someone who just exiled you from their family. But yeah, I don't know. That's something that comes up for me.
Yeah. So I think the first thing I'll say is I think it's impossible to get the bitter taste out of your mouth.
Yeah.
I don't think there's
no explaining it away.
Yeah. I don't think there's any kind of like explanation that rids the pain. And that leads to me a bigger consideration of, I think, God's orientation to pain and an invitation for us and our orientation to pain. Like, I think particularly in a Western context where we are anathema to pain and so much time, energy, and money is spent to avoid pain of any kind. That actually, it seems like there's a place, a very definite place in God's plan and in God's design for pain. And
Yeah.
But what kind of pain? I kind of, you know, the being stabbed or having surgery, that kind of idea. But that said, the sense that I make of it for today, this may change in the future. For me, I see. For me, what makes sense is God having to be faithful to God. And it kind of leads to this question, like, what's most important to God? And I kind of grew up tacitly believing that, like, man was most important to God, you know, like, hey, like, died for us and he so loved us. But I think what's clear is, like, if God is who God is, what has to be most important to God is that which deserves to be most important, which is God. And so chief at God's heart is God's own glory and self. Because it's demanded. And in that regards, when it comes to God's plan, just like with the covenant, and, you know, God walks through the covenant on makes the covenant with himself, essentially. I think God has to fulfill and keep his own plans in and to and of itself. And so what I mean by that when it comes to Hagar is that God had made a promise to Abraham that he would be the father of many nations. And God wants to bless those who come in the lineage of Abraham. And the mechanisms for that in this time that God had set up evoked ceremony. There's always this kind of, like, we call them sacraments today, you know? But, like, there's always this kind of, like, there's a outward showing of an inward working.
Yeah.
Right? And so I come to faith in Christ inwardly. I outwardly show that through baptism. What happens when God gives Abram the covenant in Genesis 12? He reaffirms it in Genesis 15. It's in Genesis 17 that we get the sacrament. The sacrament is circumcision.
Yeah.
But what happens in 16? In 16, Hagar is pregnant when she leaves. Ishmael isn't born.
Right.
God's promise is coming through this covenant, and the sign of the covenant, the outward showing, is circumcision. If Ishmael stays out in the wilderness, he doesn't get circumcised.
Right.
He doesn't get grafted fully into this plan. And so God sends Hagar back, not because he's dismissing her cause. And I think that's why it's so important that he names what he's sending her back into. And he's giving her, he sees her, and he's giving her a promise. Like, here's why I'm even sending you back. I'm giving you a vision that there will be freedom for your son and for your family to come. And he sends her back. And in 17, he goes to Abram and says, hey, now you're Abraham. Now you got to circumcise everyone. Ishmael is one of the first people circumcised. And now when he goes back again in 19, when they end up back in the wilderness, this time they don't get sent back. Now they stay in the land of flourishing. And so that's the sense I make that, like, God will endure pain and invites us to do the same, so that we can walk ultimately in his ways, which are good.
And it's funny, actually, I think that the second time they're sent out into the wilderness after Isaac is weaned, it's interesting too that God says, you know, Hagar says, I can't watch my child die. They're dying of thirst. And then Hagar, he says, you know, take your child by the hand. I will make of him a great nation. And at that point now, the separation, which seems like a curse, the separation is necessary for him to become a great nation. Now he actually has to be separated from his father. And the one who will care for them as they grow is the Lord.
Yes. Yes. But there's still, like, the 14 years.
Yeah.
There's still the 14 years, which takes us into a question that was asked this Sunday, which was, how do you hold waiting and expectancy at the same time? Like, so Hagar gets this promise, hey, your line's going to be free from slavery. but also go back, and it's 14 years later until the fullness of that. So there's, how do you do that?
I mean, that's kind of my life right now, waiting for this child to be born. It is waiting and expectation.
Okay, Pastor, look at you just reaching for those sermon illustrations.
Come on, give a preacher a mic.
Say more.
Careful. I'll say more. So I think, for me, I'll turn to another mother of scripture, a Mary, the mother of our Lord. And there's always something that struck me in her narrative, that as, you know, as she's listening to the announcement of the angel Gabriel, she asks this question, how will this be? And I think that how will this be is obviously connected to her virginity. But also loaded into that is the reality of being an unwed, pregnant mother in a Jewish context in first century Palestine. And so for Mary...
So you're saying how will this be?
Exactly. I see. How will I be okay? How will this come to pass? And then also, too, what we also know of infant mortality and also what would happen to mothers, there's also all that loaded in.
Sure.
So her...
That's good.
All that's loaded into her waiting and her expectation. And so I think the balance is, as we're waiting, we have... The pain of waiting is not knowing the outcome. The expectation is the joy of the possible outcome. And in between, I believe, in between that is faith and trust. And so how do you reconcile waiting and expectation? Well, we realize that between the pain of waiting and the joy of expectation is this necessary gap, which is faith, which is to say, Lord, I don't know how this will be, but I am sure of what will be done. And so I think for me, that's the invitation. I think that's what Christ calls us into, is then to dwell in that gap, not to be expectant and oblivious to the pains of waiting, not to be so mired in our waiting that we can't see the joy of expectation, but to live in the messy middle. And that is the realm of faith, as the author of Hebrews says, is faith is a substance of things unseen, to live in that reality of the unseen, to live in the reality of the messy middle.
Yeah. You know what comes to me when I listen to that is, again, kind of circles back to that, what's the deal with pain? You know, it's like a Seinfeld bit, you know?
Yeah.
And we cannot speak to this at all.
Yeah.
But I would imagine if we had Janice here, your lovely wife.
Yeah.
And all the nights she's had already.
Yeah.
That this child has already caused her pain.
Yeah.
And you by extension, but nothing compared to what she's experiencing.
Yeah.
I would imagine that if you gave her the choice, even in this waiting and expectancy, she would take the pain.
Yeah.
Like, it's worth it because of what's coming.
It's funny. She has a thing. Every time she lies down to go to bed is when the baby starts doing backflips.
Yeah, get used to that. That's it doesn't stop.
Yeah, it probably doesn't. Yeah. And to the point, though, for Janice, though it's annoying, because I'm trying to go to bed.
Sure.
It is also this great comfort to her, because it's like almost a reminder, before I go to bed, I'm here. And that, I think, is, again, that messy middle of, this is uncomfortable, I want to go to bed right now, but oh, the expectation when you're doing backflips outside this womb. And that's actually what allows, so actually the pain and kind of the experience of the uncomfort of the waiting is actually what breeds the joy of expectation.
Oh, okay, that'll preach.
You know. Oh,
okay.
We'll save it for another Sunday.
Yes. I love it. Well, I think another aspect of kind of this pain, right? Because a lot of times, again, if God calls us to pain, and typically pain, in my experience of life, comes from something we don't have, something we need. And there was a question around desire And it, what was sent in was, does God rebuke vain desires, but grant those that bring about power which glorifies him? Here's how I understand this question. Maybe you understand it differently. Yeah. Like I'm taking this question as speaking to like, I'm waiting, like there's something that I want, but it's not like the Bible, like the church approved desires.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
You know, like
there's no verse for it.
Yeah, like, you know, like, Lord, I would like be able to own a home in New York City. You know, whatever. Yeah, yeah, like something like that. Like, and it's like, oh, this is what I want. But God doesn't really like those desires. He wants like the Christian coded like desires.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like, Lord, I want, like, I want to like
give me a house in New York City so I could be a witness to your city.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. But even kind of that, like it, like those things that just feel ultimately like, Lord, I'm just torn because I either want to be a missionary or a pastor and I just don't know what my desires are.
Yeah.
You know, but it's like sometimes I just kind of like want a parking spot. Like, we know you want to
be an, yeah.
You know, whatever.
Yeah. Or like, we know you want to be an actor.
Yeah.
It's okay.
Does God care about that? Like, yeah. if it's only like your desires to be a pastor, yeah, versus like, I want to be an actor. Because in part, I want an Oscar, you know?
Yeah.
And what do we make of that?
Yeah, I think for me, I'm interested in the use of the word vain. Because I wonder, in question asker, if you're listening to this, maybe you can clarify for us. But when I hear the word vain, I hear maybe subtly a disdain that's comes up when we think of the process of discernment and decision making as a Christian life as a process between choosing what is good and what is evil, or to choose between what is godly and what is ungodly. And so actually what we don't know how to do, if we operate in that dichotomy, we don't know how to explore issues of discernment that are morally neutral. That neither path is the quote unquote the good thing or the God thing or the evil thing or the, and I think part of this, I think maybe speaking to the narratives we were in, is these women's desire for children aren't rooted in like, we want to continue the promise.
Yeah.
They're rooted in, I want to be loved by my husband.
Oh yeah.
And yes, that's a morally neutral thing, right? There's no kind of good or right answer here. And so I think, yeah, that's part of what I'm hearing in that, is that to say, does God care about vain things? It's really to ask, does God care about the morally neutral in my life? Or do I need to see my Christian life as a decision between the good and the God and the worldly and the evil?
Yeah. Or is God that kind of friend that only cares about what I care about if it serves them?
Right. We need like a funk flex bomb.
Yeah, I know. that's a tough one, I have to admit. Because I would say, as a pastor, as a pastor, and as I've sat with people, there is a sense, even as I read the story and I make sense of it, where like, true fulfillment comes out of, you know, this kind of gets into Christian hedonism, that like true joy comes from desiring God, being satisfied in him.
Yeah.
And it kind of goes back to what I was saying earlier about God. If the most important thing to God has to be God, the implications to us then means that like, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. Like, what should be most important to me is God. So there is an aspect that, yes, God cares chiefly about those things. I think of like Numbers 20, where when Moses strikes the rock instead of speaking to it, and the condemnation that God gives is like, you didn't trust me enough to display my goodness, my holiness to the people. Like, that's why you're in this power, is to show who I am. So there is this aspect of that. And also, though, the scriptures say that he's a God that desires to give good gifts.
Yeah.
You know? And like, I guess the best sense I'll make of it, just to kind of get us along, we got to wrap wrap this podcast up, but as a father, I love my son deeply, and I am deeply actually concerned with his, like, the most base of his desires. He, like, James has he's a huge popcorn head. Like, dude is like we've stepped up the Boatwright popcorn game. We've got, like, nutritional yeast going on.
Oh.
I've been dabbling in, like, you know, some cayenne. Like, we got some saison. We haven't gotten to tagine. I know that's probably, you know, your people, but we're I can't quite go there, but you know what I'm saying? But, like, I really care that he loves popcorn so much so that I, like, went out and bought a, like, awesome little silicone thing that pops popcorn like 30 seconds so I can just hook him up randomly.
Yeah.
And so I care about it, and also I have a larger awareness of a healthy diet than he does. So where he would eat popcorn for every meal and not feel the need to eat anything else, as his father, I'm like, bro, I want you to have popcorn, but there's limits on how I can give it to you. For your sake.
Yeah.
And you kind of got to trust me on this. It won't even make sense to you if I try to explain it.
Yeah, as I hear that, and again, we can move past this, but just the last thing I'll just as I'm listening to is, I wonder if you would get any less pleasure from watching your son enjoy this thing you've made for him if he didn't, at every moment of enjoying it, directly reference you. Or if you simply take good pleasure in his enjoyment. So it begs the question, can, for the Christian, enjoyment be an end in and of itself?
I see.
Without making an enjoyment a step towards some more, what we perceive as a deeper spiritual end. But God, does God simply delight in our enjoyment?
I hope so.
Yeah, me too.
I hope so. I know that, I will say this again, fatherhood, it teaches you so much, but there's a face he makes when like, sometimes I just do it just for the fact to love to see his face. And I'm like, I'll pick him up from school. And the other day I was like, we got on the stoop and I was like, ah, buddy, I got an idea. And I was like, ah, never mind. You're going to think it's dumb. You don't want to hear it. And he's like, no, tell me. He's like, what is it? And I'm like, no, don't worry about it. He's like, no, dad. Okay, here's my idea. I was thinking, maybe we go inside, we do our routine, get our clothes, get our shoes off, and go to the potty, and then we, like, eat some popcorn and watch some marbles on YouTube. He watched marbles videos. It's a whole amazing other thing. But I was like, you wouldn't want to do that. and there's this moment where his eyes, it's like he just got pure ecstasy.
Yeah.
And he's just like, oh, yes, that is my jam. Like, yes.
Yeah.
And it is like, I don't know if I've tasted many things sweeter. I don't know if I've seen greater sights than the joy that's in his heart, because a deep desire and longing. He doesn't have to thank me for it. I don't make him say thank you. It's not really about me, in as much as I just get to savor him being happy. And I have to believe that comes from God.
Yeah, I agree.
All right, resources.
Resources. So I've referenced him before, but I think it's worth it again. So Jonathan Walton is an Old Testament scholar, has written a lot of good scholarship, but also a lot of good popular level resources. When we say popular level, it's just resources that are easy to read and explore if you don't have a background in biblical studies or whatever.
Push up your glasses more when you say that.
Yeah. Popular level. Nah. It's called Ancient Near Eastern Thought in the Old Testament. And I bring us this resource because cultural context plays a huge role to understanding the Old Testament. And I think more of us in order to read these texts well and faithfully, need to steep ourselves in its ancient context. And so, yeah, I offer you that. It's a good book.
So, I've got an article. I referenced it this past Sunday during Q&A, but it's by Patrick Crayer, and it's called God's Promises to Hagar in Genesis 16, Rethinking a Problematic Text. This was huge for me in really kind of shaping what's happening in that moment. He goes through more Hebrew than I know or could say succinctly on this podcast to kind of really reframe what I had always grown up seeing as a curse of Ishmael as truly a blessing. And so yeah. I'll give that to people. And then Hagar is a figure that I just really loved. I think I'm particularly drawn to women as theologians like Renita Weems. And so I just love the work that they've done around Hagar and mapping the experience of Black women onto Hagar. But anyway, all that to say is I actually have a paper that I've written about Hagar as a marginal figure that I'll throw up and has a bunch of different resources, even brings in some like Muslim, some synthesis with Islamic views of like Hagar, as she's known in Islam. That, yeah, I will offer it to people just to learn more about this woman. So
dope.
Great. Well, next week, the children.
Yeah.
Joseph,
the man himself.
Many colors. I would love, we should cut off the podcast, but after we cut it off, I want to hear like, what was your greatest present? Like Joseph got the coat of many colors. I want to hear what your coat of many colors is. But for now, let's say goodbye.
Yeah, goodbye.
Till next week.
Next week.
Here on Between the Lines.
Peace. What is my code of many colors? Okay. All right. So this sounds terrible, but as a child of divorced parents, you have a lot of guilt that circles. Uh-huh. And I remember one time, I think I must have been 15, my father just walks in. He's just like, hey, Merry Christmas. And he just hands me like this big box. And this dude got me like an Xbox and like the new iPod Nano. And at that moment, I was like, man, this divorce might have ruined my family. But damn, these gifts are good.
I love that because it is the, it's like the good, you can't escape the pain. Yeah. It's like mine would be FUBU for us by us.
Ooh.
Was the joints. Vincent Vu, I don't know if you listen to this wherever you are. He was the coolest kid in middle school. He had all the FUBU and the polo, but that's besides the point. We were poor growing up. Divorce probably sounds kind of nice, actually.
Well,
like,
Satan meant for evil, yeah, God said, turns exactly. for good.
But we were so poor. And then one Christmas, my parents got me a FUBU jacket.
Oh, that's fire.
Well, the pain. Oh. Where's the pain?
Oh, okay. The pain's here coming.
Again, we were poor, so they got it, like, they probably got it at, like, Burlington Coat Factory. Shout out to those who down south who know about Burlington. And it was probably, I'm imagining, probably, like, what was on the like, left on the rack. Because it was a FUBU jacket, but it was neon blue and neon yellow. I looked like a school bus. I looked like when the school bus picks you up at night and it's got the reflectors on.
Yeah.
And I was of size even then. And so I thought I was so cool until the first day I wore it. And someone was like, you look a school bus. And I got ragged in my FUBU jacket.
But you look fly doing it.
I did not. That was the point. But anyway.